Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Kenneth Frank. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thanks, Anna. Okay. We see that we've got a number of people out here from Tar River, Clemson, Astronomical Society of Northern New England, Stillwater Stargazers, East Central Minnesota Club, which is a new club, Statesboro, Brighton. I have to say aloha to John in Hawaii, and of course, Christian Bergman as well. So now that we've kind of gone through who the folks are, we want to welcome you to our Night Sky Network's bi-monthly 2010 series teleconference. And we're pleased to have Dr. Alan Harris as our speaker this evening as we feature our kickoff of Space Rocks, the Toolkit. We also have the pleasure of having our ASP expert toolkit maker, Vivian White, who will not only be listening in along with all of us this evening and monitoring Night Sky Info at astrosociety.org, but will give you a bit of background in our latest and greatest toolkit, Space Rocks. Hi, Vivian.
Hey, Ken. Well, I just want to let you all know that we have gotten over 100 clubs that have qualified for the toolkit so far, and the feedback we've gotten has been great. They're really loving the meteorites and the Earth and Moon banner especially. So if you're one of the clubs that's gotten one, I hope you're enjoying it. If you have any problems opening up the manual on the manual resources CD, there was a formatting issue on one of the titles. So if you have any problems with that, you can also download the manual as well as all the activities from the Night Sky Network website. And if your club hasn't qualified for the toolkit, you can check out what you're missing by searching the website under the category Toolkit Space Rocks. So just a little background about the toolkit. It was funded by the National Science Foundation, NSF, as a part of a collaboration with the Space Science Institute. They have a National Center for Interactive Learning. And the main drive of the project is a museum exhibit called Great Balls of Fire. And that's going to be coming to museums across the country beginning in next year, probably next summer. And I think they're going to be starting in Richmond, Virginia. So we're excited to partner with them on that. And Dr. Harris has been a huge help answering questions along the way and reviewing toolkit materials. He has been such a pleasure to work with and is an amazing scientist. So I'm excited to hear his talk this evening. Thanks so much, Alan.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Vivian, for that excellent information on the toolkit. Now I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Alan Harris, who's a senior research scientist at the Space Science Institute and who is trained as a theorist, specifically in orbital dynamics, but quickly became to appreciate the need to tie theory to observations and likewise to direct the course of observations by theoretical considerations. And the most substantial of these has been a broad study in the hazard of impacts on the Earth by asteroids or comets and what to do about it. Dr. Harris's presentation evaluates the present and future ground-based surveys and the implications of large increase in the near-Earth asteroid discovery rate, the NEOs. And without further ado to our telecon audience, please welcome Dr. Alan Harris.
Oh, thank you, Ken. I presume all of you have the PowerPoint presentation in one form or another, either on the web or downloaded as a PowerPoint. If the latter, you may have some slides that don't carry numbers on them. Not everyone ended up with a number. If the former, if you're following along on the web, you've got a toolbar with the slide numbers okay, but a few of those slides, of which I'll mention, have some little problems with the plot points on some of the graphs. But without further ado, then, let's get started on this. What I want to talk about, then, is the risk of asteroid or a comet striking the Earth and causing global havoc. And such concerns have been with us for a very long time. They're obviously very real. If you look at the second slide, slide two, across the bottom are pictures of Jupiter with comet Shoemaker-Levy scars across one of its bands. The next picture shows Meteor Crater on the Earth, which many of you have probably seen, a nearly mile diameter crater on the Earth. Obviously, if that happened in your backyard, you wouldn't be here to listen. So the third picture there is Tunguska, an event that happened in 1908 in Siberia, and blew down trees over an area about the size of Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway. So these are very real. There's no question that cosmic catastrophes can happen, but they happen so infrequently that we have never had one actually happen in all of our human experience historically. And so it triggers sometimes irrational beliefs or worries and concerns, and so we have to ask the question, what should we really believe or do about these things? How should we respond to this risk? Well, on the next slide, 3, is a quick thumbnail overview of my talk or what I'll talk about. In order to assess the real risk from the asteroid impacts, we first need to measure the population so we know how many there are out there and how often they hit the Earth. We need to assess the damage that we expect for a given size of impact, knowing the frequency, and then put those two factors together to come up with a measure of risk with respect to time, you know, like we do with earthquakes. How many thousands of people per year are expected to be at risk from this kind of a hazard? And we can then put that in the context with various other risks we face, like earthquakes and volcanoes and so forth. Lastly, then, I will talk about the matter of survey completion. How are we doing at finding these objects in space? And what is the what I call residual risk? What is the remaining risk from that part of the population that we have not yet discovered? And that will complete the part of my presentation on the real risk. Then I will conclude with a brief talk about what I call disasters imagined. That is a neo-catastrophism, claims that we have been subjected to impact damage that has caused everything from ice ages to medieval disasters of one sort and another, biblical disasters and so forth. I've seen an upswing just in the last few years, which I'll come to. Well, going on now to slide 4, this rather formidable plot that I have here is an estimate of the population, number of near-Earth asteroids that cross the Earth's orbit, as a function of size. On the bottom is a scale in absolute magnitude, which is a brightness in the sky at standard distance, and is an astronomical magnitude scale. So since you're all amateur or professional astronomers or educators, I hope you know the magnitude scale. That would be the brightness that such an object would be if it was 1 AU away from both the Earth and the Sun, which would put you on the Sun if you were observing that. We can translate that then to a rough diameter scale, which is the very bottom scale, in terms of kilometers diameter of these near-Earth asteroids. And then on the vertical scale on the left is the cumulative number that we estimate or have discovered as a function of size. And so any one of those dots you see on the plot is the estimated number that size and larger. So the number, say, at 1 kilometer diameter, which is around 1,000, that means we estimate there are 1,000 that large and larger. Okay, that kind of settles this plot and defines it. What I want to talk about on this is the way we make this estimate, this row of blue dots, and this is the dots that are difficult to see on the web version of the plot, but on the PowerPoint version, they're big open blue circles. And they represent our best estimate of the population as a function of size of the near-Earth asteroid, total of them if we knew them all. And the way we make this estimate, in the very largest size, I've labeled in blue over there, just find them all. That's the straightforward way. After you quit finding any new ones, every time you look up, you see the ones you've seen before, but you never see another one. Then you can conclude that you found them all, and so you whatever number you've discovered, that's the population. Then in the next size down, which I show in a little green bar, is a range where when we look at the objects in somewhere in that size range, we see new ones all the time. We run the telescope, say, for a year or 2 years, and you discover, say, 50 new objects in that size range. And at the same time, you reobserve, say, 50 of the ones you already knew existed, that you previously discovered. Well, if you see 50 new ones and you see 50 of the old ones, you have a pretty good reason to assume that you have therefore found about half of them. So that this redetection ratio, the fraction of objects already known compared to the total number detected, is a good measure of what the total population ought to be. It's sort of like pulling marbles out of a bin and marking them, putting them back in, stir them up, and pull them back out and see what fraction have marks on them. It allows you to estimate how many marbles there are in the bin. So that works just fine until we get down to a size, in the case of asteroids, about 100-meter diameter, where we're just not seeing the same one over and over again, or even a second time. Every time we look, we see, say, 50 new asteroids in that very small size range, but we don't see even one a second time that we already knew was there. Well, the redetection ratio quits working at that point. You have to have some redetections to make that mathematical assumption. So at that point, we depend on the relative detection efficiency. We can estimate from computer models that if a asteroid of one size has a, say, 30% completion, then at a smaller size, we would expect a known or a measurable lower completion. Now, if you jump on to the next slide, slide number 5. The curve on the left is a computer simulation of surveys, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but basically bigger objects are on the right and smaller objects to the left, and this differential completion is a measure of, on the computer simulation, how complete a survey is at a given size, where the bottom scale is in magnitudes, equivalent to sky magnitudes, if you like, so that if you're 50% complete at magnitude level 2 here, and then at magnitude level 1, you would be 30% complete, and so on, so that you can make a relative judgment of how complete you are, and in a sense, bootstrap your way to still smaller sizes and completion levels where you're not seeing the same objects more than once. And that's what we do then to estimate, say, the number of objects as small as the ones that caused Tunguska. These very small objects, the ones we discover in the sky, we see only once, and we don't stand to ever get very complete in our survey of those really tiny things. Okay, returning now in slide 6 to that same population model. This is our best estimate as of 2006 or 7 of the population of near-Earth asteroids, and I will just jump straight away to the next slide, slide 7. This is a new population estimate that I've just completed in the last week or two. I have not yet published this. I haven't even sent it off to NASA yet, but this is my latest estimate of the population of near-Earth asteroids. And if you flip back and forth between 6 and 7, you will discover that very little has actually changed. In a sense, this gives us some level of confidence that we actually do know the population within a factor of 2 or so, even down to this very small size range. With using the very latest data, I was able to actually carry on a little bit smaller. So I have estimate numbers posted on this last slide 7 that go even smaller, all the way down to things only about 5 meters in diameter, really tiny asteroids that would never make it through the Earth's atmosphere. So this is the population that we are pretty confident we are confronted with in assessing the real risk of impacts. And if you look at the scale over on the right-hand side of that figure, you'll see impact interval, which really is just the impact interval that a single object would have divided by the number of objects at a given size range. And that tells you how often objects of a given size might hit the Earth. In the case of this size that I've indicated as Tunguska, objects around 50 meters in diameter or so, we only expect one of those impacts about every few thousand years. One happened only 100 years ago, which is a bit of an anomaly, but not too terrible. The KT impactor that killed the dinosaurs is indicated over on the right hand of the plot, an object about 10 kilometers in diameter. And such an object as that, or an impact that large, would only be expected about every 100 million years, and that's satisfyingly close to when the last one happened. So there you have a quick summary of the impact frequency. So let's now move on to the second of those issues, the so-called kill curve. What is the impact damage as a function of size of the object? And I can break that down into four subgroups here, as I've done with these four bullets in the plot, or the slide number 8. Below a diameter of around 30 meters, the atmosphere pretty well shields us and very little ground damage occurs. Now, something 30 meters in diameter only enters the Earth's atmosphere every century or so, so it's not a surprise that we don't have these things raining down all the time. In fact, since two-thirds of them come down over the ocean, I really see almost none of those. The Tunguska event is about the only one that has really happened in the last century or two. In the next size range up, say 30 to 100 meters diameter, we have mostly an airburst in the atmosphere, and it would mimic rather closely a nuclear explosion. It's a little more effective than a nuclear blast because of the momentum of the incoming meteoroid actually carries the blast down. So instead of getting a mushroom cloud that goes up, you get a blast wave that goes down. And it actually is somewhat more damaging, but the nature of the damage is pretty similar to nuclear blasts, which have been studied in quite good detail. So we can estimate pretty well what the damage from that size would result. Next size up, between 100 meters and 1 or 2 kilometers diameter, you actually get a crater if it hits the ground, and if it hits the ocean, you could expect to get an ocean tsunami that could cause shoreline damage and perhaps affect even more people than if it had hit the ground over land. Then, above 1 or 2 kilometers in diameter, we have a problem of global environmental effects, similar to the so-called nuclear winter that's been described as a possible outcome of a nuclear holocaust. We think an asteroid 1 to 2 kilometers in diameter or larger would cause such a thing, and the actual local damage, or the damage caused by the direct effects of the blast, would actually be much less than the consequences globally due to causing agricultural failure or just general global warming or cooling, one or the other, and so forth. So that 1 to 2 kilometer threshold was our first goal, was to find everything that large and chart it out and make sure we didn't have something like that with our name on it in the next century or so. Well, here I want to skip over some material just in the interest of time, but you can, if you have the downloaded presentation, you can go through this and read it more carefully. This slide number 9 has an estimate of blast damage as a function of size of the body striking the Earth, note its radius, not diameter of impactor, and it covers things up to almost a kilometer in diameter. This allows you to make an estimate of the ground damage from things that resemble a nuclear blast. In the next slide, I've drawn in on a red line a revision to that, where our recent studies, because of this effect where the blast wave is directed down rather than floating back up like a nuclear mushroom cloud, we actually now think that the damage on the ground would be greater than this 1993 original plot, and the red line indicates what that revised kill curve would be like. On slide 11, I don't want to go through this. We've revised our thinking about tsunami as well, as far as how we actuarially, how do we account for the damage due to a tsunami. In our earlier reports, we thought about property damage, but we're thinking now it's probably better to score damage in terms of projected death, and that turns out to be about a factor of 10 lower than the property damage levels. Going on to slide 12, this is the kill curve that we had in our early reports prior to 2003 and even 2006 and 7. If you look at slide 13, this is the revised kill curve, which has the altered effect of tsunami and the altered effect of low, very small-sized ground damage. And if you flip back and forth between 12 and 13, you'll see that the revised kill curve is much lower in the size range between 100 meters and a kilometer, and rather higher in the range at 100 meters and smaller. So the shape of that curve has been altered, and if you step ahead then to slide number 14, you can see the effect of these two things. One, the revised population model and the revised kill curve model. In blue, the histogram in blue shows our estimated damage from asteroid impacts of all sizes, from 10 kilometers on the far right all the way down to the smallest things that enter the atmosphere on the left. And in the blue, you can see that once you get rid of the global catastrophe stuff on the far right, what remains is peaks up at around 1 to 200 meters diameter and is due mainly to tsunamis. That bump there was the reason for what has currently been talked about, sometimes called a congressional mandate, to the Next Generation Survey to find 90% of objects down to 140 meters in diameter. And I think even President Obama has mentioned this thing as part of his discussions of NASA's charge and so on. The origin of that was this: was because once you get rid of the big elephant in the corner over on the right, the next major thing seems to be this bump around 200 or 300 meters. But my latest estimates actually shift things down in the red curve to the rather smaller stuff, things that are only 50 or 30 meters in diameter. And the mid-range is rather less important, both because of the revised thinking on tsunamis and because of the lower population. If you look at those population curves, there's a dip in the population in the middle range that wasn't accounted for before. So we now it looks like that 140 to 200 meter range may not be so hazardous, and that calls into question in my mind how concerned we should really be about that. I'll just leave it at that. And the next slide, number 15, shows where we're at now. The elephant in the corner is largely gone. That is, the very large objects. We found almost all of those, so that the risk remaining from the undiscovered large objects is not so great. And most of the risk now, if you follow the red boxes, is that last few objects about 2 kilometer diameter, and then the very small stuff down in the 50 meter smaller size range. Slide 16 just shows quickly what happens if you carry on to find 90% of all objects down to 140 meter diameter. I don't want to dwell on that any further. The next slide, number 17, is a table that I generated over the years to compare risks from all sorts of other things to the asteroid risk. And this kind of puts things in perspective as to what you might be concerned about. The things on the left are probably things that you ought to validly be quite concerned about. Many of the things on the right, people are very concerned about, but mostly they're down at a level where you ought to think more about the ones on the left. Asteroids, though, do lead the list in on the column on the right, a priori, before we discovered any asteroids. If you advance to the next slide, 18, this shows you where asteroids risk is now. We've retired about 90% of the risk since we've discovered 90% of the big ones, and they, none of them have our name on it in the next short period, so we can rest easy. We now think that the entire remaining asteroid risk for the next 50 years or so is comparable to your risk of fireworks accidents or amusement park rides or things like that that you probably don't worry an awful lot about. I do have one that I've indicated with a bunch of question marks here that I haven't identified. You can think about what risk is missing. And finally, the next slide, 19, just gives the what the risks will be if we go ahead with the next generation survey and reach that goal. Well, in terms of going on to slide 20, in terms of survey completion, the blue curve here shows where we're at now with our current level of completion. We have now discovered about 85% of objects of 1 kilometer in diameter. Another smaller size that has obtained a certain amount of notoriety is asteroid Apophis, which was discovered about 10 years ago. We have now discovered almost 40% of objects like that. Apophis still, it's in an orbit that's tricky. We can't really totally rule out the risk of impact, although it's very small now. But there are people who have been concerned about objects of this sort that may come out and bite you, you could say, may actually turn out to have substantial risk, or rather they may pose a significant risk even just because of the orbit uncertainty. But we've now discovered about two-thirds of those, so it's unlikely that we'll get bit by another Apophis because we've found only one so far after finding half of them. And Tunguska's, we've found almost none of them. The red curve is the surveys that are contemplated for the next generation that should reach the 90% completion to the 140-meter diameter. And the curve that I've drawn here is non-judgmental. I've just simply slid the curve to the left until it reaches the 90% at 140 meters, give or take a little bit. And so that gives you an idea of how complete we will be as a function of all sizes if we carry on to that point. Now, as you can see in that, even the next generation surveys will be only something like 30 or 40% complete in the size range that could cause substantial ground damage, such as the Tunguska event or smaller. And that raises the question of, can we actually do better or do anything about that size range, since this red curve is about the limit of surveying and cataloging in advance. And if you go on to the next slide, 21, I did a little calculation just taking the currently known objects, near-Earth asteroids or potentially hazardous asteroids, and altered their orbits by the least amount to make them truly intersect with the Earth's orbit. So they really, truly would be on a collision course if that was their orbit. I made the minimum correct adjustment necessary to put them on a collision course, and then looked at where in the sky would they be coming from if they were indeed going to collide with the Earth. And the answer is rather remarkable. It turns out that almost all of them come from the opposition point. Well, half of them come from the opposition point. The bad news is the other half come out from the sun, straight out from the sun almost, and you don't have any hope of seeing them from ground-based telescopes. But if you can see this figure on the slide 21, they're really rather tightly clustered. The ones coming from the anti-sun direction are rather tightly clustered in that anti-sun direction, even more tightly than the whole range that we're surveying on a monthly basis. So it seems like if we can patrol this area of the sky often enough, say weekly or so, we would stand a 50-50 chance of seeing that little guy with our name on it at the last minute or the last week or something, and enough time to evacuate an area if that became necessary. So short-term warning is actually practical at about the 50% level. If you go on, the next slide, 22, shows you how much warning time we could buy with existing surveys. Our current surveys are reaching to about limiting magnitude 20, which this sloping line that cuts almost straight through the center of the plot on figure 22 is about the level of our current surveys. Anything big enough to hit the ground or cause ground damage, the vertical line that's at H magnitude 26 or so, you can see could be detected about a week or 10 days out with the current surveys. So if we patrol the sky, that area of the sky shown in the previous slide, at least once a week, we're almost sure to see one coming from the outward bound, or the inward bound coming from the anti-sun direction. Almost certain to see it in time that we could actually take some action. And as you go up to Tunguska size and still larger, you have even more warning time. And as we go to the newer surveys, it will go even deeper magnitude, these other parallel red lines, we would have weeks or even months of warning. So the prospects are really not so bad for seeing things in advance of impact with enough time for civil defense-style protective measures. Now, on this plot is this little object called 2008 TC3. This is the one asteroid that has ever been discovered in advance of hitting the Earth. In October of 2008, a fellow by the name of Richard Kowalski, pictured in the next slide, 23, discovered 2008 TC3 using the telescope that he's pictured standing in front of. And 17 hours later, the asteroid he discovered came into the atmosphere over the desert in Sudan and is now known as the Amahata-Sita meteorite, strewn meteorite field. And Richard is holding up a piece of that. So there he is, smiling with his pet rock. I think he deserves to call this his pet rock. In front of the telescope he used to discover it. So that shows you that it can be done. We can catch these things before they hit, and this one was too small to cause any ground damage of any consequence. So there's every hope that in the future we can have at least 50-50 protection for the half that are coming in from the outward side. Well, that concludes what I wanted to say about the real hazard. I'll leave the conclusion slide 24. You can read that in your spare time after the presentation here. Now let's turn to the matter of this risks imagined. Throughout history, actually going back to the Bible and even pre-biblical writings and so on, people have worried about death from the skies and catastrophes. In fact, even the very word disaster means a bad star. So people have attributed bad luck, catastrophes to cosmic effects forever, in effect. And rather recently, though, there's been an upswing in this, starting perhaps with Velikovsky in 1950, wrote the book Worlds in Collision. He wanted to have the planets Venus and Mars swinging by the Earth and causing disaster and so on. Well, as his knowledge of astronomy was a little wanting, and that's really not possible. More recently, though, a couple of British scientists, Klube and Napier, have promoted the concept of what they call coherent catastrophism, claiming that the Earth is subject to enhanced impacts from a swarm of comets or something like a giant meteor stream that could strike the Earth. And they blame this coherent catastrophism for various environmental and societal things like Noah's flood and Middle Age climatic variations and the fall of the Bronze Age and all sorts of stuff like that. Most recently, then, this fellow up at Berkeley, Richard Firestone, put out a popular trade book that I pictured here on the right of the slide, claiming that a supernova explosion triggered a comet shower, which in turn caused what's called the Younger Dryas climatic disturbance, and claims that that led to the extinction of the megafauna in North America 13,000 years ago. So I wanted to just take this most recent one as a quick example of this kind of stuff, which I frankly regard as pseudoscience, but I think it's something that the public will ask about. So those of you in astronomy clubs, classes, and so on may get asked about this stuff. It's good to reinforce yourself and know about it. Slide 26, here's a quick thumbnail sketch of Firestone's claim, and that is that supernova went off 41,000 years ago, delivered blast waves of radiation and ion and gas and so on over the millennia, and finally 13,000 years ago a multiple comet impact equivalent to a 4-kilometer diameter impactor, which he claims led to the Younger Dryas climatic disturbance and led to the extinction of the mammoths and the saber-toothed tigers and all those lovely folks, and also claims to have brought an end to the Clovis early American Indian culture. He also attributes this to some things called Carolina Bays. I don't want to go into that, but you can Google those and enjoy reading about Carolina Bays. There's all sorts of speculative stuff on the web over those. I've sometimes compared this scenario to the six blind men examining an elephant because a number of my colleagues and scientists have latched on to little bits and pieces of this, and it seems that different people kind of try to fit this big picture into their particular specialty. So the paleontologists see one part that they like, but you know, they overlook the fact that the cosmology is all crazy, and the cosmologists have a different idea, and so on. Or the people setting impacts into the atmosphere. So everybody's just feeling at this big creature at different parts. I fancy myself as being that guy at the back lifting up the elephant's tail, and so you can guess what I'm finding. But anyway, if we go on to the next slide, 27, here's our plot again. So we can ask the question, irregardless of this business about comets and supernovas and so on, what is the chance that the Earth suffered an impact by something 4 kilometers in diameter only 13,000 years ago? Well, according to the impact frequencies that we estimate, something that big, even if an asteroid, would be once in 10 to the 7th year. So that means it's only one chance in 1,000 that such a thing may have happened only 13,000 years ago. So on the right off, you have to say that such a hypothesis is highly improbable. That's not to say impossible, just improbable. And anytime you have something that's very improbable, you have to ask, what is the evidence for it? How secure is the evidence? And I would claim that the evidence isn't very secure at all. If we turn to comets, which is what Firestone actually claims, they're about 1,000 times less prevalent than that, or 100 times less prevalent, excuse me. So the probability that a comet-like object would have hit the Earth in the last 13,000 years is 10 to the minus 5. It's really, really low. Slide 29 I want to skip over, but I invite you to go read that and think that over about the matter of odds, and it's the whole issue of does improbable mean impossible? And the answer, of course, is of course not, but improbable has to be thought about. Now, if we look at the possibility of a comet shower, Firestone is thinking in terms of triggering a shower with a supernova. This has been looked at before, particularly with regard to the possibility of a shower of comets at the 65 million year ago extinction of dinosaurs. And on that time scale, it kind of works. What happens is when you study what happens if you shake up the Oort cloud of comets surrounding the solar system, it takes a couple hundred thousand years for those comets to even fall into the inner solar system. So you can see that the response of the Oort cloud is very slow compared to 13,000 years. You just wouldn't, even if you shook it up 50,000 years ago, you wouldn't have a comet entering the inner solar system in a few thousand years. And the half-life, the dying down of the comet shower, is of the order of a half a million years. So whatever we had 13,000 years ago, we would still have today. So shaking up comets from the Oort cloud doesn't work. On the next slide, 31, I go through the same argument for Jupiter family comets and asteroid impacts, and you get the same general pattern. The bottom line is that the solar system, once polluted, doesn't clear out very fast. So if you inject something like a comet Shoemaker-Levy 9-like stream of stuff into the inner solar system, the Earth intercepts a tiny, tiny fraction of that, and what's left is still there. And it's still there for thousands and thousands of years, even tens to hundreds of thousands of years. The analogy I make to this is like a smoke-filled room. You know, if a pot catches fire in your kitchen, you can fill the kitchen with smoke very quickly in a matter of seconds. But even after you open all the doors and windows, it takes quite a while for the smoke to clear out. And the inner solar system is very much like the smoke-filled kitchen. If you had ever injected a bunch of stuff that would cause a shower of impacts into the inner solar system only 13,000 years ago, it would still be there. We would still see all of that junk. The shower would not go away. You can think of ways to create it that fast, but you can't clear it out. So the bottom line is that these possible ways of creating a shower just don't work. Well, the next couple slides are on supernova triggers and things like that. Again, I invite you to read these later. I don't want to go through them in detail right now. So the bottom line of all this, slide 34, is that, as I just mentioned, that the various triggers and showers and so on simply don't work. So it's not a plausible hypothesis to have a stream of impactors 13,000 years ago that was there then and gone now. Finally, I'll call your attention to an article that my colleague David Morrison wrote a few months ago in the Skeptical Inquirer, this is slide 35, where he asked the question, did a cosmic impact kill the mammoths? And he covers a lot of the same material I've just gone over in greater detail, actually, so I recommend that article to you. His last paragraph, I think, is interesting in that he draws, to some degree, a parallel with the neo-catastrophists and some of what we see in the current climate denialism, if you wish, where people claim that the humans are not affecting our environment. I'll read this last thing. It says, there's a long tradition of catastrophist ideas going back to the biblical flood in Plato's story of Atlantis. philosophically, many people prefer the idea that humans have not had much effect on the planet, either 13,000 years ago or today. Better to blame thunderbolts from the gods than to accept responsibility for a stewardship of the Earth. And I think that kind of an attitude drives a lot of some of this neo-catastrophist thinking. Well, with that, I will stop and open things to questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Be sure to unmute your line and record your name clearly when prompted. I do need your name to introduce you for your question. So again, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1.
Alan, I really like slide 27 idea. It's good slide 25, rather, to give amateurs and those at the museum so they can basically have some kind of fodder to quell these sort of these concepts that people have of that. That's great.
Yeah, I find myself being asked these things, and Dave Morrison, who wrote the article on the in the Skeptical Inquirer, found that he has a web page that's called Ask the Astrobiologist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets
mm-hmm.
all sorts of people asking about these end-of-the-world things in the 2012
mm-hmm.
and
actually,
so on and so on.
We have a podcast of that on the ASP website.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to listen to that,
yeah,
it's definitely there for our amateurs and others listening in. Anybody have a question?
We do have a few questions on the line here.
Oh,
our
good.
First one comes from Darian O'Brien. Your line is open.
Hey, Darian.
Hey, how are you doing? Good to hear from you. And, Alan, thank you very much from that fabulous presentation and your plots. Although they're multi-axis, I think you've used both the X and Y axis to the maximum in terms of showing all the different components on a single plot, and I applaud you for that. It takes me as an engineer a little bit to get adjusted to what all is being shown, but two questions for you. First of all, Richard Kowalski, I thought that was an interesting, as an amateur astronomer myself, boy, would I ever like to have access to his telescope to help out with the search for the NEOs and NEAs of the night sky.
Well, Richard started out as an amateur astronomer, by the way. He was in Tampa, Florida. He had an 8-inch telescope in his backyard that he used for discovering asteroids back in the 90s. I first met Richard back then, and he subsequently got a job running the telescopes in the Catalina Sky Survey. So
that's how he got. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But my question was, Time magazine put out a Time Nature's Extremes that they put out. This was back. I'm looking at the time frame here. It was back maybe a couple years back, and I have a copy of this. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but they had a very interesting article that they discussed the Apophis. And, you know, they said that, and I had read this years ago, I have the astronomer's name correct, Michael Brown from Harvard. I don't know if that's the right
name. Well, there's a Michael Brown, but he's at Caltech.
Or makes
discovered
sense.
Discovered the Eris and the other dwarf planets at upstage Pluto.
I may have the wrong name fellow that did some of the original trajectory work, but in this, they were saying that Apophis is next scheduled to whiz by the Earth in April 2029 on the unsettling date of Friday the 13th.
Yep, that's
and,
exactly right, Friday
and
the 13th.
In 2036, and on the second flyby, often they say that is even more interesting than the first because it will be so close to the planet's surface that it will pass beneath the geostationary satellites that transmit TV signals and GP coordinates. And I just wondered on that day, because I'm planning to be there, will my TV reception be interrupted at all?
No, not at all. the actual close pass by the Earth is in 2029 on Friday the 13th. That's when it passes. closer to the Earth's surface than geostationary satellites. However, it doesn't do that at the equator. The closest point is a long way off the equator, and it passes through the equatorial plane, that is, orbit plane, where the geostationary satellites are, considerably outside of it. So there's absolutely no chance of a collision or any interference or anything like that. But these are the kind of interesting little statistics that get tossed out and end up in Time magazine that sometimes get people worried about these things, when, in fact, the only real value of those is the fact that it's coming damn close. You know, it's not that it's going to interfere with your television.
Right. And is there anything as amateurs that we – I know I have an 8-inch telescope myself, and just wondering, is there an active – like, for instance, who are making the current trajectory predictions? Is that available to the general astronomical amateurs, or is that something that is – universities or something, and it's kind of hush-hush?
No, it's all completely available. If for any given object, like Apophis, for example, you can go to the website of the IAU Minor Planet Center, which is run out of Harvard but is under the auspices of the IAU, and you can go to an ephemeris generator program and just type in the object you want and the date interval you want, and it'll tell you where these things are. I haven't actually tried this, but I assume you could type in Apophis for April the 13th, 2026 or 2029, and it would give you the ephemeris, you know, where to point your binoculars or whatever. But so there's no secrets in any of this stuff. It's all right there.
Well, it'd be great, Ken. Yeah. Can we put that on our website?
Add just as a sad note that the former director of that, Brian Marsden, passed away this morning.
Yes, he just passed away.
That's very sad news that I have. I've known Brian since 1973.
Actually, that it was Brian Marsden, not
Brian,
Michael Brown.
Brian Marsden. Yeah. Well, he just died this morning, I'm glad to say.
Wow. Thank you.
If you can find the websites there, or you can contact me, I can give you the various websites. And the JPL also has an ephemeris generator. If you go to the NEO pages at JPL, you can find essentially the same thing. And, you know, you can look up tables of when things will pass close to the Earth and so forth, and just type the object and the date into the ephemeris generator, and it'll tell you right where it's going to be.
Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Wes Walkie. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you. Just on the last comment that the last guy made, I was just thinking, if Apophis is going by, and then with Virgin Galactic, that'll probably be a boost in space tourism on that day. Everybody want to go up and see it go by or something.
I'll be lucky to see it at all. I'm only 7 years younger than Brian Marsden.
Okay. My next question is, what type of techniques or devices or whatever are they using to detect these? Because I'm thinking that obviously not all of these are going to be necessarily in maybe visible light spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Well, mostly we're using visible light telescopes. It is true that asteroids only reflect something like 10% of the light that hits them, and the rest of that energy is re-radiated thermally. And so the natural question is, why don't you just use a thermal detector and look for the other 90% of the energy that's coming off of them? And for a period of time, that was done with this Weiss wide-angle infrared survey explorer that was launched a little more than a year ago and carried on a survey for most of a year. It's now run out of coolant so that it's not able to observe in the wavelengths of the thermal re-radiation, that is 10 to 20 microns. And during its time, it was really very effective at seeing these things. But the problem is, even though you get 10 times as much energy coming off of asteroids in the thermal infrared, are the technology of detectors, the field of view and the sensitivity and so forth of our detectors, is not as good there as it is in the optical. So I think for the most part, the optical wavelengths, that is visible light, are still the most productive way to search for asteroids. But, in principle, we could survey in the infrared. And as the technology improves, maybe that will become favored.
Now, is there things, maybe they're doing something similar to, say, like Kepler, where they're just staring down into space waiting for objects to move in front, I guess, or something like that?
Yeah, Kepler is a rather different thing, where you're
right.
monitoring light to see a blink out or a fading as a planet passes in front. What we need to do for finding asteroids is use a very wide field of view and just cover as much of the sky as you can, as fast as you can.
Now, I read an article here a while back that they were using telescopes around the world and claiming that they should be able to take a nightly or every other day a picture of the entire sky.
Yeah. Yeah, there are two or three proposals running around right now. I just refereed a paper, in fact, that was submitted to the publications of the ASP to do exactly that kind of thing and scoping out what's required to carry out such a survey. And it's becoming practical. Their plan was to survey every day, survey essentially all the visible sky from a location.
But my last question is it better to maybe try to detect these things from, say, like above Earth's atmosphere rather than through the atmosphere? Would we have a better chance of detecting them?
In principle, yes.
Okay.
And then it's just a cost-benefit thing, what's it worth
sure.
to you?
right.
Space missions are real expensive, whereas a backyard telescope is considerably less.
Right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
As a reminder, if you do have a question, you may press *1 on your touch-tone phone. Our next question comes from Bruce Tinkler. Your line is open.
Good evening. One thing that I did want to mention has already been mentioned about the sad passing of Brian Marsden.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate the thoroughness of the discussion of the subject tonight, because it does allow us to point out to the public that we come in contact with at star parties or other events about the likelihood of any serious damage happening in our particular neighborhoods. The other comment that I did want to make is that the other thing that detecting these asteroids or objects before they actually enter the Earth's atmosphere is that it does give us an opportunity to do some science on those objects as well. And it was really interesting that with 2008 TC3, given that kind of notice, the Clay Center Observatory in Brookline, Massachusetts, actually was able to image the object before it impacted in the Sudan. And that, of course, provides a lot of information that we might not otherwise have had if we had just been out there and found parts of the meteor itself, having observed it flying, landing in the desert there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives amateurs and other professionals an opportunity for us to expand our knowledge in that whole general area.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually participated a little bit in the Clay Center observing. They sent me a bunch of the observations right after they took them. I was at a DPS meeting, a Division for Planetary Science meeting, and it turns out that my colleague Peter Pravich was also there from Czech Republic. And when we received the stuff, we immediately started analyzing it on our laptops, and we had the first results to show at this meeting. There was a paper that was withdrawn or it didn't get given, and there was a gap in the program, and so the two of us jumped up there and presented this stuff. It's probably the fastest scientific paper ever given. It was within about 24 hours of receiving the data. It was kind of fun, but that's absolutely true. And of course, if you look at that one plot that I had on advance warning, if you go down to this TC3 sized object, Yeah, you can, even these little things that are rocks the size of a couch can easily be detected a couple days out, and you can not only, even if they're so small you don't have to run away from them, it gives you time to run to them.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
Okay, and our last question comes from Patricia Shaw. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. Thank you for your program. If one of these did show up and it was headed our way, I think I've heard something about technology involving a gravitational tractor that would might be able to bump it out of its orbit a bit. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. The concept of gravitational tractor actually was I think first put forth by an astronaut, Ed Lu, while floating around in space with in the ISS, and I have visions of him looking at things floating around in the cabin and holding his hand alongside of it to see if he could pull it gravitationally. I don't think he really did that, but while floating around in weightlessness, he came up with this idea that I had previously pointed out to him and Rusty Schweikart, another former astronaut, that were promoting sending, tugging an asteroid. They wanted to actually land on it and tug it. And I said, you know, these things are spinning. Some of them are wobbling. They're doing crazy things. Some of them are spinning so fast that you'd fly off the surface. Actually, anchoring on one of these things is the biggest problem of all. And so Ed came up with this bright idea that you don't actually have to land on it. You just get there with a fairly massive spacecraft and park yourself alongside, and Newton takes care of the rest. You know, the gravity pulls the spacecraft to the asteroid and the asteroid to the spacecraft, and then you put some ion engine thrusters on the spacecraft, and you just kind of keep standing off. You keep firing your little rockets off to the side, but in the direction of the asteroid, but off to the side. And gravity, just the natural gravity attraction, will pull the asteroid. And over a period of about 10 years or so, you can pull it enough that you could deflect it away from hitting the Earth. And, you know, I think that is just a marvelously clever way to deflect an asteroid. You know, that's what we've sometimes called the green solution. You don't even touch the thing.
Okay, well, thank you very much for everyone listening in tonight, and of course to you too, Alan, for your presentation this evening. It's been very helpful, and I, as I said, it'll really help us along in the future for at the eyepiece at star parties.
Right. Well, thank
kind
you.
Of questions
it's
come
been
up.
Been a pleasure to participate in this, and as I mentioned to you, if anybody needs to follow up with any other questions or something, feel free to email me. You can post my email on your website or wherever if you like.
Sure. Wonderful. Well, thank you so very much. And thanks again for being a part, a major part of the Space Rocks Toolkit, too.
Oh, that was kind of fun. I had the trial version of the Space Rocks Toolkit that I intend to send to my daughter, who's a middle school science teacher.
Oh, perfect.
So she'll get an early introduction to the Rocks Kit.
That's great. Well, as always, if you folks have any questions or ideas for the Night Sky Network, please let us know. Thanks for attending. Good evening and good night.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines at this time.